Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski, with my co-host, Dr. Carl, here. And this week, we got another special guest, Dr. Misra. And before this podcast, we were asking her, okay, how do we say your specialty? Because she's over in London. It's different than over here in the States. In fact, you know, my brother and I, we're DOs, and over there, we're not regarded well because they're not actually physicians over there, but over here, we're physicians. So she was explaining her background. So here's Dr. Misra. The reason we wanted her on is because she is an expert in the classification of diabetes, diabetes mellitus specifically. We've had a few podcasts on it, but she is like a world-renowned expert. Wanted to get her thoughts and chat a little bit.
Yeah. And the training is different than here, where we do internal medicine. And then I went into endocrinology fellowship. And so this is very interesting to me. And I think I might have to use this as getting some CME credits or something, because we're going to review all the things that I love to keep learning about.
So yeah, thanks for coming on.
No, I'm really delighted to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So exactly, tell us about your training real quick, and then we won't belabor, because everybody, you know, people are always like, oh, background stuff's always so boring. Let's get into it. But
this
I'm more
is cool.
I think this is
really cool
because it's
I love the fact that you're interested in it, because it's a really nerdy specialty. It's called metabolic medicine. It's a very niche specialty even in the UK. And basically, after doing internal medicine, which I did, I branched off, and then we did training in clinical biochemistry, so laboratory clinical biochemistry. And then the clinical side was diabetes, obesity, lipids, nutrition, and also some inborn errors of metabolism. So I did that training for 5 years and then did a PhD and then stayed in research. And yeah, so officially I'm a consultant in metabolic medicine, but now I purely practice in diabetes.
That's cool. Apparently I should have gone to England to learn.
That's like right up our alley. We love it.
I think it's a great specialty. I honestly do, because you kind of, yeah, really focused on metabolism.
But why are we listening to you and not some random person on Twitter?
I mean, credibility, hey?
Yes, very good. Okay, so let's get into some of this classification. We've had a podcast on this before, but you go a level deeper than what we have. I kind of want to know how you got interested in this classification thing, and then we can kind of get into the different classifications. Anything else?
And maybe reviewing what the heck is diabetes mellitus first, because I think people don't always necessarily understand what exactly that is. You know, we talked about the diagnosis. We did talk about the basics of what it is, the diagnosis, and probably we talked a little bit about the classification, but I think that's where we can, you know, get into the weeds a little bit with you.
Sure. So how did I get interested in it? Well, funny story, when I was, they're called resident doctors now here, but we used to call them junior doctors. So when I just fresh out of medical school, I despised diabetes completely. I thought it was the most boring thing. And I wanted to do endocrinology, but I thought, yeah, because if there's some ways to skip the diabetes, that would be great. But then, as I said, I fell into metabolic medicine. And what really got me hooked on classification, or, you know, understanding the differences in people with diabetes, was a patient that I saw who was relatively lean and young, but labeled as having type 2 diabetes. And this really goes against the grain of what we're taught at medical school about type 2 diabetes, right? It's a condition of middle to later ages. It's associated with overweight or obesity. So I thought, how could this person have type 2 diabetes? And it turned out that they didn't. They had a genetic form of diabetes, also known as monogenic forms of diabetes. They're rare, but they are misdiagnosed frequently. And I sort of got hooked on it and then ended up doing a PhD in it.
That's so cool. All right. I'm excited to hear this. I mean, again, we talked a little bit about it, but it'll be really cool to hear the researcher expert.
Yeah. And I guess maybe just the basics on, you know, what is type 1 diabetes? What is Yeah, I know type 2 diabetes is actually a little bit more
variable,
but for, you know, from your perspective for people. And then, yeah, I think it, I don't know, personally, I really want to talk about the little bit more rare monogenic diabetes because, you know, I get those referred to me a lot. So it's a little bit less rare for me, maybe than you, Spencer, but, you know,
but I've seen Dr. Misra talk about, some of the classifications, even in the spectrum of type 2 diabetes too, that I find really interesting. The people that, you know, maybe their pancreas isn't working as well. Some people have more insulin resistance at that. I kind of want to hear about that, but okay, sure. Yeah. Start from the beginning. Type 1. You don't have to go into depth into each of them.
No. Yeah. I won't do a 5,000 word review article on each.
Yeah.
Okay. So type 1 diabetes is autoimmune, meaning the immune system is responsible for initiating this attack on the cells that make insulin in the pancreas, which are beta cells. And we used to think that it would completely obliterate insulin production. Now we know that some people with type 1 diabetes continue to make a little bit of insulin, not enough to negate the need for insulin injection. So you need insulin for life at the moment. Some of them do produce a little bit of insulin, which can be beneficial. And type 1 is really interesting. Again, if we think back to what we learned at medical school, or I certainly learned, that it was a condition that presents in children or young adults. And, you know, they might end up in this life-threatening situation where they have something called ketoacidosis. But our understanding has really shifted on this. So we now know that a significant proportion of people with type 1 present over the age of 20. It's a diagnosis that can actually occur any time in life, at any age, and at any BMI. And yeah, it's definitely more common in younger age groups, but we see older individuals presenting with type 1 diabetes all the time. So that's one distinct group, which accounts for about 10% of all diabetes. And then the majority is obviously type 2 diabetes. How I explain type 2 diabetes to my patients is that basically the pancreas is making insulin, but the tissues, whether that's the muscle or the fat or the liver, you know, the tissues are not responding to the insulin because of this thing called insulin resistance. And it's really interesting that at a tissue level, like when you think molecularly, what is happening? What is insulin resistance? You know, I'm not sure we completely have understood what is happening at a molecular level. But suffice it to say, and again, in simplistic terms, somebody that has insulin resistance, they need to produce more insulin to have the same effect of glucose lowering. And by the time someone presents with type 2 diabetes, they've already maxed out their insulin production. So if the pancreas was capable of always just producing more and more insulin to overcome this insulin resistance, no one would ever develop diabetes. So when you actually track insulin production in its and the relationship of going from having a normal glucose to an abnormal glucose, by the time you get to diabetes, you are already beginning to lose your insulin production. And that's essentially why they tip into type 2. So that's the majority of what we see. And then, yes, there are these really some quite rare forms of diabetes hidden within that. The monogenic diabetes is one of those. But there are so many other types. I mean, our classification is quite simplistic. It hasn't changed much since the 1970s. And, you know, that you might have heard of pancreatic type 3C diabetes. And then there are lots of secondary causes of diabetes where someone's got another condition, but because of that, they're developing diabetes. So it's a lot more complex than the internet and the public probably think about. I mean, there's a lot of issues around nomenclature between just type 1 versus type 2. And there's, as you alluded to, there is a lot of heterogeneity, which basically means there are huge differences within these quite simplistic classifications. And that's really what my research is about.
Yeah, that's what I want to hear about. That's why I invited you on.
Okay.
Well, my brother wants to hear about Modi and stuff like that.
But... I guess I'll say, you know, just because clinically, obviously we deal with this all the time in my world. we end up getting referrals for a lot of patients with obesity, type 2 diabetes, and things don't always make sense. And I'm sure this is where you get into your research and expertise. And sure shooting, like you said, anybody, there's no rule that says they can't also develop autoimmune type 1 diabetes. And so we see that a lot. And you know, there's some nuance within that. And I guess one question I have for you, because I have my thoughts based upon obviously all the, you know, the science and experience that I have, but the older adults who develop type 1 diabetes, you know, the term LADA, late
adult onset,
you know, and obviously they tend to be the ones who often have residual insulin production that you were talking about. So not everyone just has zero insulin production. And one of my, what I tell people, my impression is that when that autoimmune disease hits earlier in life, you know, the pancreas hasn't fully developed and it's not doing its thing fully. But then when it hits later in life, it just seems to survive a little bit longer. And then, you know, we have ways to help try to preserve that beta cell, the insulin secreting cell, functional. But is that, is there truth to that, or have I completely fabricated that to the patients?
No, you haven't fabricated it at all. That there is some truth to that. And yeah, in simplistic terms, it sort of makes sense, doesn't it? That if you have a severe autoimmune insult, it's probably going to happen earlier on in life. There's a genetic predisposition to developing these autoimmune conditions. And so when it presents early in life, there is often quite a rapid onset with almost complete loss of insulin production. Whereas later on in life, it seems to be milder. You mentioned LADA, which is latent autoimmune diabetes of adulthood. I despise that term.
A horrible term. Yeah. That's why we basically don't use it. I just try to call it what it is, because I hope
certain people are not listening to this podcast that are great proponents of LADA. I just find it an unhelpful concept for the person living with diabetes, because essentially it is autoimmune diabetes. So you might as well call it late onset type 1.
But that is exactly what I do. I'm with you. We're on this.
I hate the term. Great. So yes, when it presents later on in life, it tends to be less aggressive. They retain some of their own insulin production. They often don't need insulin straight away. So there's a lot more monitoring. And actually, it's really difficult to make these diagnoses sometimes later on in life, because you don't always have the blood markers that we look for type 1 diabetes. And you're, as you said, and as I said at the beginning, anyone with any body weight or BMI can develop an autoimmune condition. So that it's then sort of hidden within our clinical biases, right? Because you see an overweight or a person living with obesity with diabetes, you're like, right, that's type 2. But no, it doesn't always mean it's type 2.
Yeah, I saw a guy like that in the hospital in residency. He's like a Scandinavian, very thin, very like even body composition wise, lean. Everybody, they kept throwing like, I don't know, metformin and stuff at him. Yeah. And I was like, no, this guy's got, and I checked the markers, the antibodies, and they were negative, but I'm like, this guy has it.
Because we don't have all the markers. I hate to say how long it's been since I was in fellowship, but when I was in fellowship, I feel like the zinc antibody was a relatively new antibody. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you think, you know, those we're talking like 10 years ago now. And even then I remember some of the mentors I had who were into the research of all this stuff were saying that still only accounted for what we think are 85% of the likely types of antibodies out there. Does that sound right still?
That is right. Yeah. So there's three main antibodies that we can currently measure, the GAD, the IA2 and the ZNT8. And firstly, all three of them are not comprehensively done. And the time that you want to do them is at diagnosis, right? And obviously the vast majority of older patients presenting with diabetes are not going to need this test, right? There's got to be some red flags. Like you've said, having a lean, being of lean body weight is one of them. So if you miss the boat and you don't do them at diagnosis and you don't do all three, then as you move away from the point of diagnosis, they can become negative. And then, like your patient, Spencer, that you just mentioned, the antibodies may not be positive, but it's clearly type 1 or you know, insulin deficiency. So they are available. They're not done, you have to do all three really. And I mean, certainly in the UK, not everyone has those tests available at the moment.
Yeah. Okay. Let's get into the classifications within the type 2 umbrella, because I think this is what probably most people listening would be interested in mostly.
Yeah. So this is a really rapidly expanding area of research. I think everything that I'm about to mention is definitely in the research sphere. So I think anyone that looks after people with type 2 diabetes, such as yourselves, will know that no two patients that walk through are the same, right? It's not the case that they all have a BMI above, say, 30, or they're all aged 50 to 70 or whatever. So anyone that regularly sees patients will know that there is this variation, this phenotypic variation. And so as clinicians, we tend to do different things with different people as well. I think that's been around for a while. Like sometimes you have people with type 2 that they're getting ketoacidosis, or they have super high HbA1cs and they're really osmotic, and other people just potter along and they don't shift much from their initial HbA1c. So this variability has already been noted for a long time. In 2018, there was this major publication which really catapulted the field, as sometimes these seminal papers do. And you might remember it. It was published by a Scandinavian group, and they talked about five different subtypes of diabetes based on something called clustering.
Yeah.
Yep.
And we shared the hell out of that in line.
Yeah. It was a really I have some I like that paper because I like anything that completely messes up the field, right? And gets everyone talking about it. So
I feel like I remember it, you know, to maybe to those of us that are like nerds into this space, and that includes Spencer, even though he's not an endocrinologist per se, it seemed to make sense. I feel like, we all kind of were like, well, yeah.
From a pathophysiological
standpoint. It just made sense, kind of clinically what patients look like, how they respond, and then also even the medications that we use. So
yeah. It is. It really captured the zeitgeist, because I think things had not shifted for decades, right? You had this WHO classification from the 70s, which was there throughout the 1980s, 90s, etc. I was not practicing in the 80s and 90s, FYI. And then suddenly, in 2018, it made sense. And it identified these five different types of diabetes based on something called clustering, which is a statistical method to look at different variables in big data sets and just put people into groups. And so they identified five different groups. They have really funny names, so I'm not going to mention them. They're all like these acronyms that do not roll off the tongue. But essentially, there was an autoimmune group, which are your type 1s. There was a group that had mild, older age individuals living with obesity. There was a group that had more of a lipodystrophy type of phenotype, which basically means lots of ectopic fat in the wrong place. And some other ones. And what they showed, which I think was really cool, is that you could put people in these categories on the day that they were diagnosed based on some simple data, five data points. And that classification at diagnosis related differently to outcomes. So, for example, the need and speed of getting onto insulin, or the risk of progressing to kidney failure, et cetera, et cetera. And this hadn't been shown before. So it really captured everyone's attention. And since then, the field has exploded. And, there are so many different ways that people are coming at this classification issue. But what I would say is that paper came out in 2018. So we're now 6 years plus onwards. And I don't know about you guys, but we're not using that in clinic at the moment, right? So we're missing a step.
Yeah, at least as far as nomenclature, I guess.
And I mean, we've gone from...
Probably describe it in the note, like, yeah, this patient has more characteristics of XYZ.
But... Yeah, and I was going to say, I mean, that, like you mentioned the lipodystrophic sort of phenotype. I describe that to patients as, you know, they really have minimal healthy fat cells everywhere. And they're, like you said, they're storing it in their abdomen, their liver, their pancreas, et cetera. And they tend to respond maybe differently to different therapies.
And, so my bias is that I actually think what you just described is more useful, right? So telling someone that they're in that cluster doesn't mean much, but saying, hey, you've got lipodystrophy, you know, with MASLD, so lots of liver fat and, you know, hypertriglyceridemia. So I think you're going to be high risk. Whereas, you know, someone else is in an obese weight category. Someone else is a young type 2, super high risk state to be in. So I feel like those kind of simple clinical tools are probably going to have more value, but I'm happy to eat my hat over that in a few years because the field is moving very fast.
Yeah.
Very cool. So it would be nice. Maybe just, could you describe maybe like a patient in each of those clusters, maybe? Like a case almost?
Hypothetical. Yeah. So, yeah.
And what the prevalence and estimate prevalence of like, all right, so you're going to most commonly see this. Lipodystrophic patients probably not as common.
No, I think true lipodystrophy would be uncommon. She's describing sort of that lipodystrophic.
Mm.
Yeah, the people who really they're thinner. They don't have a lot of extra body.
Okay, so more like the South Asian kind of.
Yeah, we do see that a lot. So that's not a rare.
No, okay.
Yeah. I think it's, I mean, I'll describe them in a sec. I think prevalence is an interesting question because I don't think there are good data on what the split is. And that study was done in a predominantly white European Scandinavian population. And when you do the same study in other ethnic groups, you actually see different clusters that weren't
that makes
in
sense.
The,
yeah. Yeah, like you just said, Spence.
Yeah, South Asian, yeah.
Yeah. Well, and of course, people don't perfectly fit in those cluster buckets either.
They don't.
We talked about people with obesity, insulin resistance, type 2 diabetes, who also develop type 1 diabetes. And there's this huge spectrum of overlap in theory for, you know, all of them.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Not only is there overlap, but there's people change membership of these groups. Mm-hmm. So you can start off in one group. And then if you follow up and use the same data points a few years later, then they're in another group. So there are a lot of, I mean, it's an interesting concept, but there are a lot of limitations, which is what prohibits implementation.
Yeah.
So I can tell you what I see clinically, and I'm sure this will resonate with both of you. So obviously we've got our typical textbook type 2 diabetes patient. I call it the garden variety type 2, what we learned about medical school. Mm-hmm. So the middle-aged to older-age individual living with obesity, features of metabolic syndrome. That's the patient that all the drug companies are designing drugs for, right? Like our GLP-1 agonists are perfect for that group. And all of our weight management programs aimed at that individual. So I think they're actually served quite well. And I still think that the majority of Northern European populations are going to be seeing that kind of person. Sticking with the obesity-related type 2, the major shift at the moment is the youth and young adults with type 2. So you take that exact same person living with obesity and features of the metabolic syndrome, but rather than being 55, they're 25 or 18. And I know from my US collaborators, this is a really big problem in the US. We've also seen numbers rise drastically in the last 5 years. So we've got a big problem with that too. That group is a worry because they have this burden of all of the risk factors. So not just type 2, but obesity, lipid problems, hypertension, starting from potentially teenage years or age 20. So they progress very rapidly. And that's a group where I really want to aggressively manage all of their risk factors. And you know, that in itself has issues as well.
And the fatty liver.
And fatty liver. I mean, it's a bit of a, it's a really worrying group. And that's what my research focuses on currently. So those are the obesity ones. Then you've talked about lipodystrophy. So lipodystrophy, you have true lipodystrophy, which is basically rather than storing fat under the skin, which is like a safe space, the subcutaneous fat depots, it's relatively metabolically inert. It would be great if we could all just store fat under our skin.
So rather than, you may not like how it looks, but it's actually really healthy.
It's actually really good. So rather than going there, or maybe it has gone there and it's maxed out, it's the capacity to be stored there, it then goes into other places, such as the liver, the fat, the viscera, which is that lining around all of the organs in the abdominal cavity. And this is really what the driver of insulin resistance is. And there are actually genetic forms of lipodystrophy, which are very rare. But then when we look at people who develop type 2 diabetes, which is not a monogenetic disorder, meaning there isn't one gene with one mutation resulting in type 2, it's a polygenic disorder. There's multiple changes in hundreds of genes result increasing risk of type 2. So when you look at people with type 2, some of them are on their way to developing type 2 because they are more likely to probably deposit fat in the wrong place. And there are some genetic risk scores in, again, this is all in the research field, where you can quantify the genetic risk for lipodystrophy. And so you see these people, I mean, sometimes I've actually checked them out for Cushing's, you know, cortisol excess, because they have a lot of central adiposity over the tummy, very skinny legs with literally no subcutaneous fat under the legs, and poor muscle bulk. A lot of that phenotype is genetically driven, but it's a kind of subset of the group of people with type 2. I don't know if you come across those.
Yeah, I was just going to say, not infrequently, of course, a selection bias, because I, you know, get these patients, but I have several notes that probably say, Cushingoid versus lipodystrophic appearance. And then we end up kind of evaluating for Cushing's, and then, you know, maybe treating more of a lipodystrophic sort of diabetes. Yeah, yeah, exactly right.
And these patients generally don't have a very high BMI, right? They're...
You know, I got to say something about some of the literature out there, because this is what drives me crazy, is that a lot of the studies out there talking about these types of patients with diabetes or with fatty liver or whatever else, they call them lean because of their low BMI. They're not lean. It's just a different where and how they're storing
where
the
they're
fat.
Storing
that's,
the fat.
Yeah, I don't know. That's my little soapbox.
I was gonna say, Dr. Misra, do you know Sam Klein? Dr. Klein, he kind of looks at the metabolically healthy versus unhealthy obesity. He does these lectures and shows, like, kind of basically a lot of it's genetics of where they store the fat.
Yeah.
And the immunofunction of the fat cells. It's kind of interesting. It's like, some people are like, why do I store things there? It's like, I want to store my fat right in my thighs and my butt.
Exactly. And I mean, this is why, so 2 points in response to what you just said. Firstly, this is why the stigma around having type 2 diabetes, and, you know, you did it to yourself. It's wrong. It's fundamentally wrong, because, there may be excess nutrition or physical inactivity, but, you know, the gun was loaded, right? And then there's a trigger. So people's genetics are influencing their baseline risk. But then, there has to be something environmental on top. So this where you deposit your fat is a great example of that. And the other point, so BMI is a bit of a blunt instrument. I mean, it's a great population level tool, but as you've said, this is where it falls down, because they do often have a reasonable BMI, but they're metabolically obese on the inside.
Yeah. Do you work with Roy Taylor at all? And all that, you know, the pancreatic fat, you know, weight loss with intensive diet can still help even those who have the low BMI sort of lipodystrophic pattern type concept.
Familiar with Roy's
since you're
work. With Roy's work. He's a collaborator of mine on one of my PhD students. So, I mean, exactly that. And you know, one size does not fit all, basically, mm-hmm. when it comes to type 2.
Yeah, because you can't just give everybody a low-calorie diet and expect to fix them, right? It would probably help more and so in that first group that you
Exactly. described. It's perfect for that first group. And I mean, the last group that I wanted to mention, which, to your point, are these people who don't even necessarily look metabolically unhealthy on the inside, right? So these are your lean type 2s. Maybe they don't have evidence of lipodystrophy. And, you know, those are the ones that I'm looking for adult onset type 1 in. If they're under 30, I might be screening them for genetic forms of diabetes. And invariably, you come out of that kind of filtering process and you found nothing. And this is why I think our classification system, you know, is still so simplistic, because how can you label a lean person that still has some insulin production? How can you say that that's type 2? And then you know what that label leads to, right? So over here, if you're labeled with type 2, you're on the weight management program, you're eligible to look for low calorie diet, people are giving you other weight loss medications. So it's very knee jerk. And I think the nuance is lost with that label.
So what the hell's going on with them?
Well, I guess I want to ask you, so in your practice, and I know how, you know, we do it here, and, you know, we have some guidance on how to do this, because now we're looking for those MODYs and stuff like that. And so how do you personally, and then also kind of in general over there, do it, if it's any different than how we do it? But a lot of it is just what you said, when it doesn't make sense, especially the family history is a big deal in these, but there are some other little things that have come up that made us look into it. But just your opinion.
So in answer to what the hell is going on in there,
exactly.
There is, go back to what I said right at the beginning. You know, I said that when you're on your way to developing type 2, you've reached your peak level of insulin resistance and you've maxed out your pancreas's ability to produce any more insulin. So it's only when you've maxed out your pancreas's ability and it starts dipping that you get diabetes. So if you just imagine that in the same way, there's a spectrum of insulin resistance from people who are severely insulin resistant, you know, all the way down to not very much, there's also a spectrum of your ability to produce insulin, so-called beta cell function. And that is genetically driven. Mm-hmm. So you, South Asian and East Asian people are far more likely to develop type 2 diabetes and have a normal BMI. And there's now good evidence to suggest that when you look at their genetic scores for beta cell function, they just have intrinsically lower beta cell function capacity. And so when, if you think of it as a balance between your insulin resistance and your ability to compensate for that, then leaner people by definition have to have lower beta cell function. Mm-hmm. So what's going on in them is that even if they're modestly overweight on the inside, or not visibly overweight, the pancreas just cannot produce enough insulin. And in some cases, that might mean that it's actually been type 1 all along, and that the immune markers are not there. But what we tend to see is we don't see antibodies, and we just hypothesize that they must have lower beta cell function to begin with. So I think there's some good evidence emerging on that.
And how do you
how do you decide if they're MODY?
So there's a couple of things there. So firstly, age. So the vast majority of MODY, which stands for maturity onset diabetes of the young, we tend to say monogenic diabetes these days. Most of them present before the age of 30, nearly all of them by 35/40. So that's your first discriminator. Then we tend to check the antibodies to make sure there's no pancreatic antibodies. And we also check C-peptide, because most of the monogenic diabetes cases will still continue to produce a little bit of insulin. So if you see zero insulin production, that fits more with type 1 diabetes. There are a few caveats to that, but I think for the podcast that's type 1.
Could you explain what C-peptide is real quick?
Yeah, sure. Sorry. So C-peptide is produced from the human pancreas at the same time as insulin. So it's a really good measure of the person's ability to produce insulin. because if they're making C-peptide, then they must be making insulin. And the reason we don't always measure insulin is because sometimes people are taking insulin injections and then you don't know, well, okay, the insulin level is this, but is that because it came from the injection or did it genuinely come from the pancreas? So we measure C-peptide instead.
And do you measure that fasting?
Actually, for classification purposes, a random one, like that's when the glucose is high enough. So we use most people, as long as the glucose is above 8, which I know that you use different units, but if you do 8 times 18, which I'm not going to be able to do in my head, that's the cutoff. So as long as it's above that,
that's right.
Okay. Well, what is it?
144.
Yeah.
Okay. That sounds right. So actually a random one's pretty good. As long as the glucose level is high enough, then you get a stimulated C-peptide.
Yeah. Patients always love when I say, okay, we're going to check this and I need you to eat, go enjoy a meal first.
Yeah. Have a carby meal.
Although, you know, it's interesting. We also have to use it. I don't know about over there, but for patients with type 1 diabetes, a lot of times for coverage of their insulin pumps and stuff, they require patients to have like a zero C-peptide. So we actually then have them do it fasting just in case, like you said, they still have residual beta cell function. So we don't want it to be high in those cases if they eat and they still get some good C-peptide response. So anyways, we use it in that case too. But
wow. Okay. We don't have to do that.
So let's say it's a 50-year-old because they're past 35. So you don't think it's this monogenic diabetes and they have some residual pancreatic function, so you're less likely the type 1. But you said there is still some residual in some of those older. How are you differentiating?
I run a regional clinic called the non-classical diabetes clinic for these patients, and it's completely overbooked and there's like a 7-month wait list to come to see me. It's really difficult, really, really difficult in some ways at the limit of how far we can go to classify these individuals. So one of the modifiers in my mind is then, are they overweight or not? I come back to this basic biology of it's a balance between the level of insulin resistance and the beta cell function. So if they are really overweight and they're still making a lot of insulin and the type 1 diabetes antibodies are not there, then in some ways, the classification is sort of academic because losing weight is going to be helpful. And if they've got some of their own insulin production, then you can leverage that with whichever treatment you want to give, right? The group where there's not enough insulin production, they're heading towards insulin. There's not much else you can do in that group, but weight loss may also be beneficial. So it's quite difficult to decide in that group. And then I sometimes look at are the lipids out? Are there other features of metabolic syndrome? And then in our guidelines, at least if you're over 50 and you have any red flag symptoms like rapid weight loss, or change in bowel habit, we also do pancreatic imaging for pancreatic cancer, which can sometimes present with new onset diabetes. So yeah, I have this kind of filtering process to go through it. But invariably, fortunately, people don't have these horrible other conditions and you're just like, well, we're at our limit. And I think the key thing there is to monitor, because it usually, you know, the trajectory that it takes reveals itself after, you know, maybe a year or so.
And, you know, depending on their story, like, you know, the family history and all that stuff, we will do genetic testing and counseling. Do you guys do that much there for the monogenic diabetes?
Yeah. I mean, if they're younger, so I wouldn't in a 50-year-old, but if they are, our guidelines are if they're under 30, they will be eligible for genetic testing on the basis of this certain criteria. So you expect to see a parent with diabetes, at least one. Residual C-peptide levels. We tend to test all of the genes in one go. But as when they're older, the incidence is just so much lower. So it's unlikely to be monogenic.
Yeah. And for people listening out there, I think one of the reasons why I do feel it's very important, and I think we all think it's important to actually have a diagnosis, is because some of those specific genetic syndromes can be treated very differently than we would say your garden variety type 2 diabetes. Like the most common one, if my statistics are correct, and actually another one or two, can be treated with the medicines we used to use more often called sulfonylureas. We just don't use them a lot in type 2 diabetes because they just directly stimulate the pancreas to make more insulin, but they work very well in those people with those specific genetic receptor defects. I don't know if you have
absolutely. Yeah. So the two most common types of monogenic diabetes, not to get too technical, but they're called glucokinase and HNF1 alpha. Those are the genes. And in the case of HNF1 alpha, which is probably the most common one, mm-hmm. you can use once daily low dose sulfonylurea tablet. So if you picture it, because a lot of these people, 80% of these people are misdiagnosed as having type 1 or type 2. So in some cases, people are on pumps or they're on insulin mm-hmm. injections and they have been for 10 years. And then you actually, you know, you see someone and they query the diagnosis and then you can get them off of the insulin onto this once daily mm-hmm. tablet. And the naysayers might say, well, why do an expensive test, right? Insulin's going to bring down the blood sugars. And the reason is that when you actually put them onto the correct, precise treatment, so this is a great example of precision medicine in diabetes, then they actually achieve better HbA1cs than when they were on insulin. Mm-hmm. So it's really worth it for those individuals. It is rare. It's about 3%, 2 to 3% of all cases of diabetes diagnosed under 30 turn out to be monogenic. The other one, which is amazing, I'm just going to mention this, is the glucokinase. Mm-hmm. Which if you had a mutation in that gene, it actually doesn't need any treatment at all. It just causes very mildly raised blood sugars that's non-progressive and is not associated with complications. And it's like, it's a fascinating condition. And there's loads of people out there that don't realize they have glucokinase.
Yeah. So that's, I mean, yeah, maybe that's the most important because we've definitely been able to tell people, you don't need to do anything. Just keep living your healthy life. Of course, don't tell that to the people who think a banana making your sugar go to 138 is going to kill you.
Yeah.
What's the defect in the HNF version?
Oh, so HNF1 alpha is a transcription factor. So this is a type of protein that controls in the cell. It controls all of the production of different proteins and the machinery to produce insulin, basically. So HNF1 alpha it's in the pancreas and it's controlling, in simplistic terms, the ability to produce insulin. So if you have a mutation in that gene, just one copy of the gene, there's two copies of every gene, then very simplistically, your ability to produce insulin is halved, I guess you could say. And so sulfonylureas are a great drug. They've been around since the 1940s and they work by boosting your own insulin production. So as you say, we tend to use it less in people with type 2 now, but it's just the perfect treatment. In fact, it's so good that you have to give a tiny, tiny dose. Otherwise, they have really severe hypoglycemia.
I've seen that for sure.
Yeah.
And then the glucokinase, you know, that's the next most common one. That's more of a kind of a glucose sensing issue, right?
Yeah, it's fascinating. I could do hours on this. I won't.
And we could listen to you for hours, but
yeah, I would.
It's like, so glucokinase is this thermostat for the beta cell that makes insulin, right? So it's just like you said, it's sensing how much glucose is around in the blood. And then when it rises above a certain level, it's going to cascade a chain reaction of events that results in insulin production. So it's the chief sensor. And so if you have a mutation in the gene, then basically it's slightly dodgy sensor. So rather than kickstarting insulin production at a normal blood sugar or just when you go slightly above your normal blood sugar, I'm avoiding saying the numbers because I can't do it in milligrams
That's okay.
per deciliter.
That's fine.
Rather than doing it that, it might do it at, say, a higher glucose. It just doesn't function as efficiently. And so this thermostat is set at a higher level. But the key thing is that downstream of that, everything works perfectly. So the factory is in perfect condition. The insulin production the production line is perfect. And so it is intriguing that despite having slightly raised blood sugars, they don't go on to develop the major complications.
That's good.
But I think it's because all of the downstream machinery is working.
Yeah, that's very awesome.
Good. Cool. All right.
How about neonatal diabetes? How often?
Yeah.
That's one I don't know. I don't know that I see a lot of that at all.
No. So neonatal diabetes is very rare. And basically, it's a genetic form of diabetes again, but it presents at birth. So nearly all cases of neonatal diabetes present in the first 6 months of life. And the team in Exeter in England, led by Andrew Hattersley, who's a mentor of mine, they've done groundbreaking research in all of this and discovered the key genes that are causing the diabetes at birth. So for a long time, people thought this was type 1 diabetes presenting, you know, in the first 6 months of life. But actually, most of them, the majority of cases are due to a mutation in the very specific protein in the beta cell that is very important in causing insulin production. And it just so happens that protein, it's a channel in the membrane of the beta cell, is the channel that the sulfonylureas bind to, these drugs that have been around for, you know, 80 years. So actually you can give them these babies sulfonylureas high dose, and then they don't need insulin and they achieve really good blood sugars
for the rest of their life.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It's really, I mean, if anyone's interested, they should, there's some amazing, YouTube videos of children that, because in some of the syndromes, they also have neurological deficits because this channel is expressed in the brain as well. And then you put them onto these high dose sulfonylureas and babies that were, like, you know, children that were unable to walk are suddenly walking because they, so it is really rare. I don't want to get the listeners' hopes up over this, but it's very rare, but it's another great example of where precise treatment actually leads to better outcomes.
Spencer's wife is a neonatologist. I wonder, Spencer, if Jenna's, I don't know. I don't know that she and I have talked much about it, but if she's had any experience with that.
I think they've looked. All right. I have a few clinical questions.
Sure.
Do you ever measure fasting insulin in the, like, pre-diabetes or people you're suspecting have insulin resistance, that type of thing?
You know what? I don't.
No, I'm asking because it's like a big
thing. That's what we're expecting.
It's a big thing.
It is a big thing. And it's really interesting because a lot of private, so I mostly practice in the NHS here, but when you go and see private doctors, they're often doing fasting insulin. I don't do it because it doesn't really alter my management. But that's mostly because by the time they come to see me, they've already got diabetes. Yeah. So I don't find it. It's a useful research tool, but I don't use it clinically.
Yeah, we tell people all the time that it's kind of evolved, I think, in our practice. Because way back when I was a student, I knew some endocrinologists who did do that, but we also didn't have a lot of the therapies we have now. And we keep asking people, well, how is it changing your management?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, even people with pre-diabetes still don't have like 100% chance of progressing on to type 2 diabetes. I think there's a statistical sort of issue. I mean, people who don't even have pre-diabetes, just because they have some insulin resistance, it's not going to change what we do necessarily. So
there are some people doing glucose tolerance tests and then they add insulin at every time they check, and they show, you know, they have all these different types of curves and they're like, oh, these people have XYZ higher risk of cardiovascular disease, whatever. These are people getting into the weeds, but I'm kind of with you in that, like, I don't know. I haven't seen it change my management. The only thing I can think of is that it might motivate a patient to go, hey, here's a biomarker showing that you're insulin resistant. Your glucose is normal, but your insulin's pretty high.
Yeah.
But you have the other, you know, your triglycerides are like 125. I don't know what the conversion is here.
Metabolically sort of healthy.
But like some of us,
but they don't realize.
Bit, you know,
that
waist circumference is a little bit. Yeah. So that the only thing that I've seen that be maybe motivating. What about, we've done a few CGM.
I knew you were going to mention the C word. I knew it was coming.
The C word. Other people use C word for other things.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, dear God.
This is my C word.
This is your C word. Okay.
I already got fired. So
do you use? Yeah, you're going to private practice. It's okay. We've almost gotten fired multiple times from our own podcast, so it's okay. We don't want to get you fired, Dr.
No, I don't.
Do you use CGMs in patients who, when do you use a CGM?
Okay, so I mean, in the
continuous glucose monitor for those listening that don't know what it is. Okay.
So I have somehow become the kind of de facto grumpy scientist / clinician in England about CGM outside of diabetes. So I keep getting asked to comment on various for various journalists and things. So I've done a lot of reading around this. So at the moment, CGM, we use it routinely in people with type 1. And anyone on with type 2 diabetes who's on insulin and, you know, has to modify their insulin doses is also eligible for CGM in our National Health Service. So that's fully funded. But like you, I've seen people that maybe they have pre-diabetes or maybe they don't have diabetes, and they're going and buying these CGMs and using them to try and understand more. And I said at the beginning that I'm trained in biochemistry, right? And so when this first happened, the purist nerd in me was just, you know, aghast with despair over the fact that these slightly inaccurate sensors were being used in this way in effectively healthy people. I think that part of me is a bit more suppressed now, because I think that one of the things I've reflected on is that everything that we have done in glucose-related biology has been around defining what disease is. So we're really good at defining what diabetes is, but we haven't really spent a lot of time defining what normality is. And so although I, like you, I'm very skeptical of what the value of this is, I worry that there's a group of people who it creates health anxiety, unnecessary mm-hmm. health anxiety in. But I think we do need some research to really understand the specific subgroups where it could add value. For example, some people with pre-diabetes don't progress to type 2, but are a higher risk of developing cardiovascular disease later on. And so maybe, I don't know, maybe there's a way of identifying those people for using these tools. And as you say, it might be a really good tool to modify behavior. But we need to show that in good quality studies.
Yeah.
And we need to understand the harms. And none of that has happened. So I'm a little bit skeptical about it at the moment.
Yeah, it goes back to my banana example, because a lot of it's the keto zealots, the low carb evangelicals out there who are promoting the CGMs, and it's like there are a lot of healthy foods that will make a healthy or even someone with pre-diabetes or type 2 diabetes make their sugars go up, their blood sugars go up, but it's better than chowing down on processed meats, fatty meats, for example. You know what I mean? I get worried about that. I mean, certainly we can provide education along with it, but it's like, you don't have to have, a fasting sugar of, a normal fasting sugar and then keep it there all the time to have a healthy glycemic.
I mean, that's exactly situation, the point, isn't it? That there's somehow, I don't even know how it's happened, but somehow this idea of having a flat line mm-hmm. is healthy has just come into mainstream, despite there being no evidence to back that up. And
right.
I mean, when I'm feeling cantankerous and I want to sort of poke the beast on social media, I sort of come out with these statements that, like, evolutionarily, if we produce a hormone that is, bringing things down, then actually there might be some biological value in having peaks and troughs. We see that in the whole of endocrinology, right? That you have rises and falls can be a good thing. So I don't know if that's true with glucose, but
right. Well, I guess my impression is that, especially like when I was going through fellowship, there was a lot of talk about glycemic variability, the huge ups and the downs. Certainly in type 1 diabetes, when you start having variability, you have risk of hypoglycemia and you have hyperglycemia. Now that's real diabetes variability. And then it somehow kept progressing to people without any diabetes.
Yeah.
And then they think a fasting sugar of 90 that goes up to you know, 139 and then back down somehow has the same potential ramifications.
Exactly.
Of people with type 2 or type 1 diabetes. And it's like, there's no reason to think that.
Yeah.
And that goes back to the kind of that, actually, the glucokinase deficiency monogenic diabetes, where they have mild high fasting sugars. Their sugars go up a little bit when they eat, and yet they don't develop the complications that we see with chronic hypoglycemia and diabetes.
Yeah.
So,
I don't know.
Here's another question, clinical question. You talked about the leaner individuals. They don't have monogenic diabetes. They don't have late onset type 1. Would a low carb diet help for those folks?
Such a good question. I'm triggered. Sorry.
Yeah, no, good. No, good. Because when you're explaining that, I'm like, okay, I want to steel man. People talk about straw man. I don't want to say XYZ. I want to steel man a low carb diet approach. Because traditionally, I like poking fun of ketogenic diets, and people know me as this kind of anti-keto. But I'm a big proponent. I don't like zealots. I love attacking the stupid bully zealots out there. But in this case, I was like, well, that'd be kind of an interesting idea.
Okay. I see so many of these people, right? So I've looked into it quite a lot. So firstly, let's start with the position that if you're lean and you've developed diabetes and there's no markers of type 1, then intrinsically you are not producing enough insulin, right? That has to be the case. So they're not producing enough insulin. There's some insulin production, but not a lot. So there's two ways to handle this. Either you boost the insulin production, and this is one group that I do use sulfonylureas in, because it's literally the only thing that's going to work.
And that doesn't worsen their pancreatic function long term.
There's no evidence.
Okay, I mean, that's good to know.
People do talk about that, but it's like literally one small study.
What about the other? They're not sulfonylureas, but like the repaglinides that are more glucose dependent. So I have one patient in mind who we use that in.
Yeah.
Because I don't know the diagnosis, and it's the one patient that drives me insane that I don't know his diagnosis, because we did all the things we've talked about, and he's older and in the greatest shape of any like 85-year-old
ever. I've
got
so many like
And we're using that, and I always, I can't tell him what's going on other than,
I mean, repaglinide's just a very short-acting secretagogue, right? So I think, same, you could use a sulfonylurea, you could use a meglitinide. So there's two ways to deal with that scenario. Either you boost the insulin production or you reduce the stimulus that's going and that's carbohydrate, right? So, I feel like when I see these people, they're often seeing me quite late and they've been under non-specialists and they've, you know, despite having a BMI of 23, they've been on the 15-month weight management program. Or they've been told to get down to a BMI of 19 or something. Knee-jerk reactions to a label of type 2, with no consideration of what that does to skeletal muscle mass, etc. So I see these people and they are frustrated and they feel guilt over having done this to themselves. And it's one of the things that really, really I get upset about as a clinician, because the one thing that I can say to someone that's labeled as type 2 but has a BMI of 22 is that they didn't do it to themselves, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is not weight related. So I, in answer to your question, there's no evidence base that a low carb diet would work better than any other diet or versus medical treatment. But often by the time I get to see them, they've been so indoctrinated with the fact that this is lifestyle related that they're scared to eat carbohydrates. And I think that's a sad indictment of the kind of protocolized approach that we have to type 2 diabetes management, which fails to see the nuance in someone that's a bit leaner. So then I just, you can eat carbs and some of them do, and then we start them on medications, but often some of them don't want to be on medications, so they continue to do low carb.
And does it help them? I don't know. I don't see these patients often.
Yeah. So the key point is how much insulin production is there. So if you've got enough insulin production to maintain a fasting glucose, right? That's the key point. So you need to, it's going to go, your blood sugar is going to go up when you eat carbs, but does it come down overnight? And can you maintain euglycemia overnight? And the actual C-peptide level does not help you to decide, you know, we didn't say that, but C-peptide levels are so useless to interpret. So it's really down to, can they maintain it? And if they can, and they choose to limit carbs, and I always say to them that I'm in the game of maintaining your quality of life, because I don't want you to get complications, because then you'll have a poor quality of life. Is doing this diet currently affecting your quality of life? Because if it is, then we've achieved nothing, right? We're back to square one. So I have that conversation. If they say, no, I'd rather just do the diet, then it will help in that scenario. If someone's not maintaining normal blood sugars between meals, then we've missed the boat and diet's not really going to help. And they do need treatment, sometimes insulin, to bring it down. So that's the other thing that I say, that, okay, low carb might work for a bit. You might need tablets, but by definition, if you're lean when you've developed type 2 in inverted commas, you're going to end up on insulin much faster than someone that's overweight.
I love it. You're not only a very smart researcher, but you're patient-centric. It's great.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're very good.
Hey, I try my best. Not everyone lovely. Likes me. Yeah.
Well, we like you. it's been lovely chatting. Anything else you want that we didn't? That you wanted to mention, but I think you kind of knocked it out of the park here.
Yeah.
Thank you. I think one thing, just going back to the CGM, I don't know if you come across this too, but you know, people do low carb, right? So they're worried about these peaks in inverted commas. I call them undulations. And then they do low carb and then they like test themselves, you know? Yeah. Right? Like, oh, let me see, let me have some carbs and look, oh my God, it's gone up so high. Yeah. And, I spend a lot of time telling people about what carb restriction does, right?
To your glucose tolerance.
Right?
There's a reason people aren't allowed to go low carb before they have their gestational diabetes screening.
Exactly, right. And this was, and they knew it in the 1970s. So when the glucose tolerance test was developed, it says in the protocol, eat carbohydrate freely for the two to three days beforehand for this reason. So I wish the companies that, no company in particular, but I wish the companies that go direct to consumer with these devices would tell people that.
I
think that's a great learning point to end on, because so many people are going to do this now that they're over the, we have over the counter versions. I don't know if they're over the counter.
Stilo, look at, I got one right here. Look at this. I haven't put it on.
We have them both from Abbott and from Dexcom now that are going to be available over the counter.
We are not paid by either of those two, but if they want to sponsor this podcast.
I can tell you who gets paid a ton of money to tell everyone to wear them. And his name is Peter Attia.
Who's that?
That's even better.
He's a guy that dropped out of her.
Wait, that's even better when she said, who's that? Peter Attia. He's a guy.
Made millions and millions of dollars being somewhat realistic and then duping people in other ways here.
Okay.
He's not even a real specialist of anything, right?
No, I don't know. He was a longevity guy.
Anti-aging. Whatever.
I will give him this. He is very smart, but he's very.
I'm gonna look him up.
I don't know if he's smarter at science or actually. I think he's smarter at marketing.
Well, of course.
And it's. I've gotten really good at marketing, but I can just see it, and you know that's fine. He's a smart guy.
He told Thor that Thor. Going into saunas will reduce your cardiovascular risk more than statins.
Yeah, that was weird. And he's a statin. He's an LDL guy.
I can't believe I haven't heard of this guy. I've heard of that other longevity guy does the bone marrow infusions.
Holy shit. I haven't heard of that guy.
Who, Brian Johnson? The guy
that spends
$2 million a year on his thing. And he gets made fun of all the time online.
I mean, it's, I've heard of him, but I haven't heard of this
other
guy.
They're making millions and I'm sitting here sucking wind being a real endocrinologist.
I know. I'm like, why am I criticizing CGM outside of diabetes? I should be like the physician that can support people to do it.
You and I could probably make another $250,000 a year from those companies by pushing them.
You could be the face of these things. You're very intelligent. And you're very lovely. So thank you for coming on.
I'm faking it, but thank you. That's really nice.
I was grilling you with some like questions that like you have to know your stuff to come up very quickly with those things. So I think anybody listening is like, this person knows what they're talking about.
We don't get fooled easily.
Yeah.
Oh, you guys are awesome. I mean, I've been following you on Twitter for ages, so thank you for inviting me. I feel very privileged.
Where can anybody find you? I mean, I know you're not a big social media, but I love following your Twitter because it's where I get a lot of research from.
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter with a very modest following. But yeah, if people want to follow me, my handle is ShivaniM_Casey.
Very good.
Good luck spelling that.
Nah, it's okay.
We'll put it in the show notes or whatever.
I'll link to it.
And I'm going to submit this for my own CME. So I appreciate it because this is obviously right along my lines of
education. I really
enjoyed
it.
So.
Thanks. You guys are, I think appreciate you're doing it. I mean, you know, when you're functioning as an independent clinician, right, you kind of see new things and then you go up and read about it and then you get your position right. We're all learning on the job. And then when I followed you guys, I was like, oh, other people will think the same thing. So I have learned so much from you both. So thank you.
Awesome. Aww, thanks.
Very good. Same as well. Here's our outro. Everyone share this with someone who's interested in all the different very nuances of the classifications of diabetes and whoever's interested in a CGM and whatever else. Thanks for listening.
Share with Peter too.
Wait, oh God, why is this thing not working?
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities.